Chapter 9. By the time they translated into their fifth ouster system, Task Force Gideon had slaughtered down to a science. Father Captain DeSoya knew from his courses in military history at Pax Fleet Command School that almost all space engagements fought more than half an AU from a planet, moon, asteroid, or strategic point source in space were entered into by mutual agreement. He remembered that the same had been true of primitive ocean navies on pre-Hegira Old Earth, where most great naval battles had been fought in sight of land in the same aquatic killing grounds, with only the technology of the surface ships changing slowly. Greek trireme to steel-hulled battleship. Aircraft carriers with their long-range attack planes had changed that forever, allowing armadas to strike at each other far out to sea and at great distances. But these battles were far different from the legendary naval engagements where capital ships had slugged it out within visible range of one another. Even before cruise missiles, tactical nuclear warheads, and crude-charged particle weapons had forever ended the era of the ocean-going surface combatant, the sea navies of old Earth had grown nostalgic for the days of blazing broadsides and crossing the T. Space war had brought a return to such mutually agreed-upon engagements. The great battles of the hegemony days, whether the ancient internecine wars with General Horace Glennon Height and his ilk, or the centuries of warfare between web worlds and ouster swarms, had usually been waged close to a planet or spaceborne farcaster portal. And distances between the combatants were absurdly short. Hundreds of thousands of clicks, often tens of thousands, frequently less than that, given the light years and parsecs traveled by the warring parties. But this closing on the enemy was necessary, given the time it took a fusion-powered laser lance, a CPB, or ordinary attack missiles to cross even one AU. 7 minutes for light to crawl the distance between would-be killer and target, much longer for even the highest boost missile, where the hunt, chase, and kill could take days of seek and countermeasure, attack and parry. Ships with C-plus capability had no incentive to hang around in enemy space waiting for these seeker missiles, and the church-sponsored restrictions on AIs in warheads made the effectiveness of these weapons problematic at best. So the shape of space battles over the centuries of the hegemony had been simple. Fleets translating into disputed space and finding other translating fleets or more static in-system defenses, a quick closing to more lethal distances, a brief but terrible exchange of energies, and the inevitable retreat of the more savaged forces, or total destruction if the defending forces had nowhere to retreat, followed by consolidation of gains by the winning fleet. Technically, the slower ships DeSoya had served in previously had a powerful tactical advantage over the instantaneous drive Archangel cruisers. Revival from cryogenic fugue state took only hours at worst, minutes at best, so the captain and crew of a Hawking drive ship could be ready to fight shortly after translating from C+. With the Archangels, and even with papal dispensation for the accelerated and risky 2-day resurrection cycles, it was 50 standard hours or more before the human elements of the ships were ready to do battle. Theoretically, this gave a great advantage to the defenders. Theoretically, the Pax could have optimized the use of Gideon drive ships by having uncrewed craft piloted by AIs flick into enemy space, wreak havoc, and flick out again before the defenders knew that they were under attack. But such theory did not apply here. Autonomous intelligences capable of such advanced fuzzy logic would never be allowed by the Church. More importantly, Pax Fleet had designed attack strategies to meet the requirements of resurrection so that no advantage would be surrendered to defenders. Simply put, no battles were to be fought by mutual agreement. The seven archangels had been designed to descend upon the enemy like the mailed fist of God, and that was precisely what they were doing now. In the first three Task Force Gideon incursions into ouster space, Mother Captain Stone's ship, the Gabriel, translated first and decelerated hard in system, drawing all long-range electromagnetic, neutrino, and other sensor probes. The restricted AIs aboard the Gabriel were sufficient to catalog the position and identity of all defensive positions and population centers in the system, while simultaneously monitoring the sluggish in-system movement of all ouster attack and merchant vehicles. 30 minutes later, the Uriel, Raphael, Remiel, Sariel, Michael, and Raguel would translate in-system, dropping to only 3/4 light speed. The task force would be moving like bullets compared to the tortoise velocities of the accelerating ouster tort ships. Receiving Gabriel's intelligence and targeting data via tight beam burst, the task force would open fire with weaponry that held no respect for the limitations of light speed. The improved Hawking Drive Hyper-K missiles would wink into existence among enemy ships and above population centers, some using velocity and precise aiming to destroy targets, others detonating in carefully shaped but promiscuous plasma or thermonuclear blasts. At the same instant, recoverable Hawking Drive high-velocity probes would jump to target points and translate into real space, radiating conventional lance beams and CPBs like so many lethal sea urchins, destroying anything and everything within a 100,000-click radius. Most terribly, the shipborne death beams would slice outward from the task force archangels like invisible scythes, propagating along the Hawking Drive wakes of probes and missiles and translating into real space as surely as the terrible swift sword of God. Countless trillions of synapses were fried and scrambled in an instant. Tens of thousands of ousters died without knowing that they were under attack. And then the Gideon task force would come back in system on 1,000-kilometer tails of flame, closing in for the final kill. Each of the 7 star systems to be attacked had been probed by instantaneous drive drones. The presence of ousters confirmed, preliminary targets assigned. Each of the 7 star systems had a name, usually just a new revised general catalog alphanumerical designation. But the command team aboard HHS Uriel had given the 7 systems target names coded after the 7 archdemons mentioned in the Old Testament. Father Captain DeSoya thought it a bit much, all this Kabbalistic numerology. 7 archangels, 7 target systems, 7 archdemons, 7 deadly sins. But he soon fell into the habit of talking about the targets in this shorthand. The target systems were Belphegor, Sloth, Leviathan, Envy, Beelzebub, Gluttony, Satan, Anger, Asmodeus, Lechery, Mammon, Avarice, and Lucifer, Pride. Belphegor had been a red dwarf system that reminded DeSoya of Barnard's star system. But instead of the lovely, fully terraformed Barnard's world floating close to the sun, Belphegor's only planet was a gas giant resembling Barnard's star's forgotten child, Whirl. There were true military targets around this unnamed gas giant, refueling stations for the ouster swarm tort ships en route to attack the Pax's Great Wall, gigantic dip ships that shuttled the gases from the world to orbit, repair docks and orbital shipyards by the dozen. DeSoya had Raphael attack these without hesitation, slagging them to orbital lava. Gideon found most of the true ouster population centers floating in the Trojan points beyond the gas giant. Scores of small orbital forests filled with tens of thousands of space-adapted angels, most opening their force field wings to the weak red sunlight in panic at the task force's approach. The 7 archangels laid waste to these delicate eco-structures, destroying all of the forests and shepherd asteroids and watering comets, burning the fleeing space-adapted ouster angels like putting so many moths to a flame, and all without slowing significantly between entrance and exit translation points. The second system, Leviathan, despite its impressive name, had been a serious B-type white dwarf with only a dozen or so ouster asteroids huddled close to its pale fire. Here there were none of the obvious military targets that DeSoya had attacked so willingly in the Belphegor system. The asteroids were undefended, probably birthing rocks and hollowed-out pressurized environments for ousters who had not chosen to adapt to vacuum and hard radiation. Task Force Gideon swept them with death beams and passed on. The third system, Beelzebub, was an Alpha Centauri sea-like red dwarf, devoid of worlds or colonies, with only a single ouster military base swinging in the darkness some 30 AUs out and 57 swarm ships caught in the act of refueling or refitting. 39 of these warships, ranging in size and armament from tiny ram scouts to an Orion-class attack carrier, were fit to fight and flung themselves at Task Force Gideon. The battle lasted 2 minutes and 18 seconds. All 57 ouster ships and the base complex were turned to gas molecules or lifeless sarcophagi. No archangels were damaged in the exchange. The task force moved on. The fourth system, Satan, held no ships, only breeding colonies scattered as far out as the Oort cloud. Gideon spent 11 days in this system, putting Lucifer's angels to the torch. The fifth system, Asmodeus, centered by a pleasant little K-type orange dwarf, not unlike Epsilon Eridani, sent waves of in-system torch ships to the defense of its populated asteroid belt. The waves were burned and blasted away with an economy born of practice. The Gabriel reported 82 inhabited rocks in the belt, harboring a population estimated at 1.5 million adapted and unadapted ousters. 81 of the asteroids were destroyed or death-beamed from a great distance. Then Admiral Aldakakti ordered prisoners taken. Task Force Gideon decelerated in a long 4-day ellipse that brought them back to the belt and its sole remaining inhabited rock, a potato-shaped asteroid less than 4 clicks long and 1 click across at its widest cratered point. Doppler radar showed that it was orbiting and tumbling in random patterns understood only by the gods of chaos, but that it was turning on its axis in a carefully orchestrated 1/10 G rotisserie mode. Deep radar showed that it was hollow. Probes told that it was inhabited by as many as 10,000 ousters. Analysis suggested that it was a birthing rock. 6 unarmed rock hoppers flung themselves at the task force. Uriel turned them into plasma at a distance of 86,000 clicks. 1,000 ouster angels, some of them armed with low-yield energy weapons or recoilless rifles, opened force field wings and flew toward the distant pack's ships in long tacking ellipses along the crest of the solar wind. Their velocity was so slow that it would have taken days to cover the distance. The Gabriel was given the task of burning them away with 1,000 winks of coherent light. Tight beams flicked on between the archangels. Raphael and Gabriel acknowledged orders and closed to within 1,000 clicks of the silent asteroid. Sally ports opened and 12 tiny figures, 6 from each ship, caught the light from the orange dwarf star as Swiss Guard commandos, marines, and troopers jetted toward the rock. There was no resistance. The troopers found 2 shielded airlock portals. With precise timing, they blasted the outer doors open and entered in teams of 3.
"Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been 2 standard months since my last confession."
"Go ahead."
"Father, today's action, it bothers me, Father."
"Yes?"
"It feels wrong."
Father Captain DeSoya was silent. He had watched Sergeant Gregorius's attack on the virtual tactical channels. He had debriefed the men after the mission. Now he knew he was going to hear it again in the darkness of the confessional. "Go ahead, Sergeant," he said softly.
"Aye, sir," said the sergeant on the other side of the partition. "Aye, Father."
Father Captain DeSoya heard the big man take a breath.
"We came onto the rock with no opposition," began Sergeant Gregorius. "Me and the 5 young ones, I mean. We were in tight beam contact with Sergeant Kluge's squad from the Gabriel, and of course with Commanders Barnes, Avni, and Uchikawa."
DeSoya remained silent in his part of the confessional booth. The booth was sectional, meant to be stored away when the Raphael was under boost or combat stations.
which was most of the time. But now it smelled of wood and sweat and velvet and sin, as all real confessionals did. The father captain had found this half-hour during the last stage of their climb toward translation point for the sixth ouster system, Mammon, and offered the crew time for confession. But only Sergeant Gregorius had come forward.
"So when we landed, sir, father, I had the laddies in my squad take the South Polar airlock, just like in the Sims. We blew the doors as easily as you please, father, and then activated our own fields for the tunnel fighting."
DeSoya nodded. Swiss Guard fighting suits had always been the best in the human universe, capable of surviving, moving, and fighting in air, water, hard vacuum, hard radiation, slug assault, energy lance assault, and high explosive environment, up to the kiloton yield range. But the new commando suits carried their own Class 4 containment fields and were able to piggyback on the ship's more formidable fields.
"The ousters hit us in there, father, fighting in the dark maze of the access tunnels. Some of them were space-adapted creatures, sir, angels without their wings extended. But most of them were just low-G adepts in skin suits, hardly any armor to speak of at all, father. They tried using lance and rifle and ray on us, but they were using basic night goggles to amplify the dim glow from the rocks, sir, and we saw them first with our filters. Saw them first and shot them first."
Sergeant Gregorius took another breath.
"It only took us a few minutes to fight our way to the inner locks, father. All the ousters who tried to stop us in the tunnels ended up floating there."
Father Captain DeSoya waited.
"Inside, father? Well," Gregorius cleared his throat. "Both squads blew the inner doors at the same instant, sir. North and South Poles at once. The repeater globes we left behind in the tunnels relayed the tight beam transmissions just fine, so we were never out of touch with Kluge's squad, nor with the ships, as ye know, father. There were fail-safes on the inner doors, just as we figured, but those we blew as well, and the emergency membranes a second later. The inside of the rock was all hollow, father. Well, we knew that, of course, but I'd never been inside a Berthan asteroid before, father. Many a military rock, aye, but never a pregnancy one."
DeSoya waited.
"It was about one click across, with lots of their spidery low-G bamboo towers taking up much of the center space, father. The inner shell wasn't spherical or smooth, but more or less followed the shape of the outside of the rock, you know."
"Potato," said Father Captain DeSoya.
"Yes, sir. And all pitted and cratered on the inside, too, father. Lots of caves and grottos everywhere, like dens for the pregnant ousters, I suppose."
DeSoya nodded in the darkness and glanced at his chronometer, wondering if the usually concise sergeant was going to get to the perceived sins in this account before they had to stow the confessional for C-plus translation.
"It must have been pure chaos for the ousters, father. What with the cyclone howling as the place depressurized? All the atmosphere flowing out of the two blasted airlocks like water out of a bathtub drain. The air all full of dirt and debris and ousters blowing away like so many leaves in the storm. We had our external suit phones on, father, and the noise was unbelievable till the air got too thin to carry it. Wind roaring, ousters screaming, their lances and our lances crackling like so many lightning rods. Plasma grenades going off, and the sound bouncing back at us in that big rock cavern. The echoes going on for minutes. It was loud, father."
"Yes," said Father Captain DeSoya in the darkness. Sergeant Gregorius took another breath.
"Anyway, father, the orders had been to bring in two samples of everything. Adult males, space-adapted, unadapted. Adult females, pregnant and not pregnant. A couple of ouster kids, pre-puberty, and infants, both sexes. So Kluge's team and ours got busy, stunning and bagging them. There was just enough gravity on the inner surface of the rock, 1/10 G, to keep the bags in place where we left them."
There was a moment of silence. Father Captain DeSoya was just about to speak, to bring this confession to a close, when Sergeant Gregorius whispered through the screen and darkness separating them.
"Sorry, father. I know you know all this. It's hard to... Anyway, This was the bad part, Father. Most of the ousters who weren't modified, space-adapted, were dead or dying at this point, from decompression or lance fire or grenades. We didn't use the death beam Wands issued to us. Neither Cluj nor I said anything to the lads, just none of us used the things. Now those adapted ousters went angel, their bodies turning all shiny as they activated their personal force fields. They couldn't fully extend their wings in there, of course, and it wouldn't have done any good if they had. No sunlight to catch, and the 1/10 G was too much for them to overcome if there had been any solar wind. But they went angel anyway. Some of them tried to use their wings as weapons against us. Sergeant Gregorius made a rough sound that might have been a parody of a chuckle. We had Class 4 fields, Father, and they were batting at us with those gossamer wings. Anyway, we burned them away, sent 3 from each squad out with the bagged specimens. Cluj and I each took our remaining 2 lads to clear out the caverns as ordered. DeSoya waited. There was less than a minute before he would have to end confession. We knew it was a Birthen Rock, Father. We knew, everybody knows, that the ousters, even the ones who've turned the machines loose in their cells and blood and who don't look anything like human, they haven't learned how to have their females carry and bear children in pure zero-G and hard radiation, Father. We knew it was a Birthen Rock when we went in the goddamned asteroid. I'm sorry, Father. DeSoya stayed silent. But even so, Father, those caverns were like homes. Beds and cubbies and flat-screen vid sets and kitchens. Not things we're used to thinking ousters have, Father. But most of those caves were...
Nurseries, said Father Captain DeSoya.
Aye, sir. Nurseries. Wee beds with wee babies in 'em. Not ouster monsters, Father. Not those pale, shiny things we fight against. Not those damned Lucifer's angels with wings 100 clicks across in the starlight. Just babies. By the hundreds, Father. By the thousands. Cavern after cavern. Most of the rooms there had depressurized already, killing the little ones where they lay. Some of the little bodies had been blown out in the depressurization, but most of them were tucked in tight. Some of the rooms were still airtight, though, Father. We blew our way in. Mothers, women in robes, pregnant women with wild hair flying in the 1/10 G. They attacked us with their fingernails and teeth, Father. We ignored them until the windstorms blew them out or they died of choking. But some of the infants, scores of them, Father, were in those little plastic respirator cases.
Incubators, said Father Captain DeSoya.
Aye, whispered Sergeant Gregorius, his voice tiring at last. And we tight-beamed back. What did they want us to do with them? With all the scores and scores of baby ousters in these incubators. And Commander Barnes Avney beamed back.
To continue on, whispered Father Captain DeSoya.
Aye, Father. So we.
Followed orders, Sergeant.
So we used the last of our grenades in those nurseries, Father. And when the plasma grenades were gone, we lanced those incubators. Room after room, cavern after cavern. The plastic melted around the babes, covered them. Blankets ignited. The boxes must have been fed with pure O2, Father, because a lot of them went up like grenades themselves. We had to activate our suit fields, Father, and even so, it took me 2 hours to clean my combat armor. But most of the incubators didn't explode, Father. They just burned like dry tinder, burned like torches, everything in them burning bright like little furnaces. And by now all the rooms and caverns were in vacuum, but the boxes, the little incubators, they still had atmosphere while they burned. And we turned off our outside phones, sir, all of us did. But somehow we could still hear the crying and the screams through the containment fields in our helmets. I can still hear them, Father.
Sergeant, said DeSoya, his voice hard and flat with command.
Aye, sir.
You were following orders, Sergeant. We were all following orders. His Holiness has long since decreed that ousters have surrendered their humanity to nano-devices they release in their blood, to the changes they have made with their chromosomes.
But the screams, Father.
Sergeant, the Vatican Council and the Holy Father have decreed that this crusade is necessary if the human family is to be saved from the ouster threat. You were given orders. You obeyed them. We are soldiers.
Aye, sir, whispered the sergeant in the darkness.
We have no more time, Sergeant. We will talk about this at a later time. For now, I want you to do penance. Not for being a soldier and following orders, but for doubting those orders. 50 Hail Marys, Sergeant, and 100 Our Fathers, and I want you to pray about this. Pray very hard for understanding.
Aye, Father.
Now say a sincere act of contrition. Quickly now. When the whispered words began to come through the screen, Father Captain DeSoya lifted his hand in benediction as he gave absolution.
Ego te absolvo.
8 minutes later, the Father Captain and his crew all lay back in their acceleration couches, resurrection creches, as Raphael's Gideon Drive activated, carrying them instantaneously to target system Mammon by way of terrible death and slow, painful rebirth. The Grand Inquisitor had died and gone to hell. It was only his second death and resurrection, and he had enjoyed neither experience, and Mars was hell. John Domenico Cardinal Mustafa and his contingent of 21 Holy Office administrators and security people, including his indispensable aide Father Farrell, had traveled to Old Earth System in the new Archangel starship Jibril, and had been given a generous 4 days after resurrection to recover and regroup mentally before beginning their work on the surface of Mars itself. The Grand Inquisitor had read and been briefed enough on the Red Planet to form an unassailable opinion. Mars was hell. Actually, Father Farrell responded the first time the Grand Inquisitor had mentioned his conclusion aloud about Mars being hell. One of the other planets in this system, Venus, better fits that description, Your Excellency. Boiling temperatures, crushing pressures, lakes of liquid metal, winds like rocket exhausts.
Shut up, the Grand Inquisitor said with a tired turn of his hand.
Mars, the first world ever colonized by the human race, despite its low rating of 2.5 on the Solmev scale. The first attempted terraforming, the first failed terraforming. A world bypassed after the black hole death of Old Earth because of the Hawking Drive, because of the imperatives of the Hegira, because no one wanted to live on the rusty sphere of permafrost when the galaxy offered a near infinite number of prettier, healthier, more viable worlds. For centuries after the death of Old Earth, Mars had been such a backwater planet that the world web had not established farcaster portals there. A desert planet of interest only to the orphans of New Palestine. The legendary Colonel Fedmon Kassad had been born in the Palestinian relocation camps there, Mustafa was surprised to learn, and to Zen Christians returning to Hellas Basin to reenact Master Schroeder's enlightenment at the Zen Massif. For a century or so, it had looked as if the huge terraforming project would work. Seas-filled giant impact basins and cichlid firms proliferated along River Marineris. But then the setbacks came. There were no funds to fight the entropy. And the next 60,000-year-long ice age arrived. At the height of the World Web civilization, the hegemony's military wing, Force, had brought farcasters to the Red World and honeycombed habitats into much of the huge volcano, Mons Olympus, for their Olympic command school. Mars's isolation from web trade and culture served Force well, and the planet had remained a military base until the fall of the farcasters. In the century after the fall, remnants of Force had formed a vicious military dictatorship, the so-called Martian War Machine, which extended its rule as far as the Centauri and Tau Ceti systems, and might well have become the seed crystal for a second interstellar empire if the Pax had not arrived, quickly subduing the Martian fleets, driving the war machine back to Old Earth System, sending the dispossessed warlords into hiding among the ruins of Force orbital bases and in the old tunnels under Mons Olympus, replacing the war machine's presence in Old Earth System with Pax fleet bases in the asteroid belt and among the Jovian moons, and finally sending missionaries and Pax governors to pacified Mars. There was little left on the Rust world for the missionaries to convert or the Pax administrators to govern. The air had grown thin and cold. The large cities had been plundered and abandoned. The great Simoon pole-to-pole dust storms had reappeared. Plague and pestilence stalked the icy deserts, decimating, or worse, the last bands of nomads descended from the once noble race of Martians. And little more than spindly brandy cactus now grew, where the great apple orchards and fields of bradberries had long ago flourished. Oddly, it was the downtrodden and much abused Palestinians on the frozen Tharsis Plateau whose society had survived and thrived. The orphans of the ancient nuclear diaspora of AD 2038 had adapted to Mars's rough ways and extended their Islamic culture to many of the planet's surviving nomad tribes and free city-states by the time the Pax missionaries arrived. Refusing to submit to the ruthless Martian war machine for more than a century, the new Palestinians showed no interest now in surrendering autonomy to the Church. It was precisely in the Palestinian capital of Arafat Kafia that the Shrike had appeared and slaughtered hundreds, perhaps thousands, of people. The Grand Inquisitor conferred with his aides, met with Pax fleet commanders in orbit, and landed in force. The main spaceport in the capital of St. Malachy was shut down to all but military traffic. No great loss, since no merchant or passenger dropships were scheduled in for a Martian week. Six assault boats preceded the Grand Inquisitor's dropship, and by the time Cardinal Mustafa set foot to Martian soil, or Pax tarmac to be precise, 100 Swiss Guard and Holy Office commandos had ringed the spaceport. The official Martian welcoming delegation, including Archbishop Robeson and Governor Claire Palo, were searched and sonic probed before being allowed clearance. From the spaceport, the Holy Office group was whisked via ground car shuttles through decaying streets to the new Pax-built Governor's Palace on the outskirts of St. Malachy. Security was heavy. Besides the Grand Inquisitor's personal security force, the Pax Fleet Marines, the Governor's troopers, and the Archbishop's contingent of Swiss Guards, there was a battle regiment of Home Guard armored infantry encamped around the palace. There the Grand Inquisitor was shown evidence of the Shrike's presence 2 standard weeks earlier on the Tharsis Plateau.
"This is absurd," said the Grand Inquisitor on the night before flying to the scene of the Shrike attack. "All these hollows and vid images are 2 standard weeks old or taken from high altitude. I see these few hollows of what must be the Shrike and some blurred scenes of carnage. I see photos of the Pax bodies the militiamen found when first entering the town. But where are the local people? Where are the eyewitnesses? Where are the 2,700 citizens of Arafat Kafia?"
"We don't know," said Governor Claire Palo.
"We reported to the Vatican via Archangel drone, and when the drone returned, we were told not to tamper with the evidence," said Archbishop Robeson. "We were told to await your arrival."
The Grand Inquisitor shook his head and held up a flat photo image.
"And what is this?" he said. "A Pax fleet base on the outskirts of Arafat Kafia? This spaceport is newer than St. Malachy's." "It is not Pax fleet," said Captain Womack, captain of the Jibril and new commander of the Old Earth System Task Force.
"Although we estimate that 30 to 50 dropships a day were using this facility during the week previous to the Shrike's appearance."
30 to 50 dropships a day?" repeated the Grand Inquisitor. "And not Pax fleet? Who then?"
He scowled at Archbishop Robeson and the governor.
"Mercantilis?" pressed the Grand Inquisitor when no one spoke.
"No," said the Archbishop after another moment, "not Mercantilis."
The Grand Inquisitor folded his arms and waited.
"The dropships were chartered by Opus Dei," said Governor Palo in a tiny voice.
"For what purpose?" demanded the Grand Inquisitor.
Only Holy Office guards were allowed in this suite of the palace, and they stood at 6-meter intervals along the stone wall. The governor opened her hands.
"We do not know, Your Excellency."
"Domenico," said the Archbishop,
his voice quavering slightly,
We were told not to inquire.
The Grand Inquisitor took an angry step forward.
Told not to? By whom? Who has the authority to order the presiding archbishop and the Pax governor of a world not to interfere? His anger boiled through. In the name of Christ, who has such power?
The archbishop raised pained but defiant eyes toward Cardinal Mustafa.
In the name of Christ? Precisely, Your Excellency. Those representing Opus Dei held official diskeys from the Pontifical Commission for Justice and Peace, he said. We were told that it was a security matter in Arafat Kefia. We were told that it was not our business. We were told not to interfere.
The Grand Inquisitor felt his face flushing with barely subdued rage.
Security matters on Mars or anywhere else in the Pax are the responsibility of the Holy Office, he said flatly. The Pontifical Commission for Justice and Peace has no charter here. Where are the representatives of the Commission? Why aren't they here for this meeting?
Governor Claire Paulo raised a thin hand and pointed at the flat photo in the Grand Inquisitor's hand. There, Your Excellency. There are the Commission authorities. Cardinal Mustafa looked down at the glossy photograph. Forms of white-clad bodies could be seen in the dusty red streets of Arafat Kefia. Even through the grain of the images, it was obvious that the bodies were mauled into grotesque forms and swollen from decomposition. The Grand Inquisitor spoke softly, fighting the urge to scream and then order these imbeciles tortured and shot.
Why? He asked softly. Haven't these people been resurrected and questioned?
Archbishop Robeson actually attempted a smile.
You will see that tomorrow, Your Excellency. It will be abundantly clear tomorrow.
EMVs were useless on Mars. They used armored Pax security skimmers for their flight to Tharsis Plateau. Torch ships and the Jibril monitored their progress. Scorpion fighters flew space air combat patrol. 200 clicks from the plateau, 5 squads of Marines dropped from the skimmers and flew ahead at low altitude, raking the area with acoustic probes and setting up firing positions. Nothing but the shifting sand moved in Arafat Kefia. The Holy Office security skimmers set down first, their landing legs settling into sand where grass had once grown on the oval city commons. The outer ships establishing and linking a Class 6 containment field that made the buildings around the plaza seem to shimmer in heat haze. The Marines had dropped into a defensive circle with the commons as their locus. Now the governor's Pax and home guard troops moved out to establish a second perimeter in the streets and alleys around the plaza. The archbishop's 8 Swiss guardsmen secured the circle just outside the containment field. Finally, the Grand Inquisitor's Holy Office security force exploded down the skimmer ramps and established the inner perimeter of kneeling figures in black combat armor.
Claire,
came the leading Marine sergeant's voice on the tactical channel.
Nothing moving or alive within a kilometer of Site 1,
rasped the lieutenant of the Home Guard.
Bodies in the street.
Clear here,
said the captain of the Swiss Guard.
Confirm nothing moving in Arafat Kefia except your people, came the voice of the captain of the Jibril.
Affirmative,
said Holy Office Security Commander Browning. Feeling foolish and disgruntled, the Grand Inquisitor swept down the ramp and across the sandy commons. His mood was not lifted by the silly osmosis mask he had to wear, its circular boosterator slung over his shoulder like a loose medallion. Father Farrell, Archbishop Robeson, Governor Paulo, and a host of functionaries ran to keep up as Cardinal Mustafa strode by the kneeling security forms and, with an imperious wave of his hand, ordered a portal cut in the containment field. He passed through over the protests of Commander Browning and the other forms in black armor who were scuttling to catch up.
Where is the first of...
began the Grand Inquisitor as he bounced down the narrow alley opposite the commons. He still was not used to the light gravity here.
Right around this corner, panted the Archbishop.
We should really wait for the outer fields to be, said Governor Paulo.
Here, said Father Farrell, pointing down the street onto which they had emerged. The group of 15 stopped so quickly that those aides and security people in the rear had to catch themselves before bumping into the VIPs in front.
"Dear Lord,"
whispered Archbishop Robeson, and crossed himself. Through the clear osmosis mask, his face was visibly white.
"Christ,"
muttered Governor Claire Paulo. "I've seen the hollows and photos for 2 weeks, but Christ."
"Ah,"
said Father Farrell, taking a step closer to the first body. The Grand Inquisitor joined him. He went to one knee in the red sand. The contorted form in the dirt looked as if someone had fashioned an abstract sculpture out of flesh, bone, and gristle. It would not have been recognizably human had it not been for the teeth gleaming in the wide-stretched mouth and one hand lying nearby in the shifting Martian dust. After a moment, the Grand Inquisitor said,
"Did scavengers do some or most of this? Carrion birds, perhaps? Rats?"
"Negative,"
said Major Piet, the Governor's Pax Fleet Ground Force commander.
"No birds on the Tharsis Plateau since the atmosphere started thinning 2 centuries ago. No rats or any other moving thing have been picked up by motion detectors since this happened."
"The Shrike did this," said the Grand Inquisitor.
He did not sound convinced. He stood and moved to the second body. It might have been a woman. It looked as if it had been turned inside out and shredded.
"And this?"
"We think so," said Governor Paulo. "The militia that found all this brought out the security camera which had that 38-second hollow we've shown you."
"That looked like a dozen shrikes killing a dozen people," said Father Farrell. "It was hazy." "There was a sandstorm," said Major Piet, "and there was only one shrike. We've studied the individual images. It simply moved through the crowd so quickly that it appeared to be multiple creatures."
"Moved through the crowd," murmured the Grand Inquisitor.
He stepped over a third body that might have been a child or a small female.
"Doing this."
"Doing this," said Governor Paulo.
She glanced at Archbishop Robeson, who had moved to a wall for support. There were 20 to 30 bodies in this section of the street. Father Farrell knelt and ran his gloved hand across the chest and into the chest cavity of the first cadaver. The flesh was frozen, as was the blood that fell in a black icefall.
"And there was no sign of a cruciform," he said softly.
Governor Paulo shook her head.
"Not in the 2 bodies the militia returned for resurrection. No sign of the cruciform whatsoever. If there had been any remnant at all, even a millimeter of note or bit of fiber in the brainstem or—"
"We know that," snapped the Grand Inquisitor, ending the explanation.
"Very strange," said Bishop Erdl, the Holy Office's expert on resurrection technique. "To my knowledge, there has never been an instance where the body was left so intact, where we could not find remnant of the cruciform in the corpse. Governor Paulo is correct, of course. Even the slightest bit of cruciform is all that is necessary for the sacrament of resurrection."
The Grand Inquisitor stopped to inspect a body that had been thrown against an iron railing hard enough to impale it at a dozen points.
"It looks as if the shrike was after the cruciforms. It tore every shred of them out of the bodies."
"Not possible," said Bishop Erdl. "Simply not possible. There are over 500 meters of microfiber in the cellular node extensions of—"
"Not possible," agreed the Grand Inquisitor. "But when we ship these bodies back, I'll wager that none are recoverable. The shrike may have torn their hearts and lungs and throats out, but it was after their cruciforms."
Security Commander Browning came around the corner with 5 troopers in black armor.
"Your Excellency,"
he said on the tactical channel only the Grand Inquisitor could hear,
"the worst is a block over. This way."
The entourage followed the man in black armor, but slowly, reluctantly. They cataloged 362 bodies. Many were in the streets, but the majority were in buildings in the city or inside the sheds, hangars, and spacecraft at the new spaceport on the edge of Arafat Kefia. Hollows were taken, and the Holy Office forensic teams took over, recording each site before taking the bodies back to the Pax Base morgue outside of St. Malachy.
It was determined that all of the bodies were off-worlders, i.e., there were no local Palestinians or native Martians among them. The spaceport intrigued the Pax fleet experts the most.
8 dropships serving the field itself, said Major Piet.
That's a serious number. St. Malachy's spaceport uses only 2.
He glanced up at the purple Martian sky.
Assuming that the ships they were shuttling to and from had their own dropships, at least 2 each if they were freighters, then we're talking about serious logistics here.
The Grand Inquisitor looked at Mars's Archbishop, but Robeson merely held his hands up.
We knew nothing of these operations, said the little man. As I explained before, it was an Opus Dei project.
Well, said the Grand Inquisitor, as far as we can tell, all of the Opus Dei personnel are dead. Truly, irrecoverably dead. So now it's a responsibility of the Holy Office. You don't have any idea what they built this port for? Heavy metals, perhaps? Some sort of mineral mining operation?
Governor Paulo shook her head.
This world has been mined for over 1,000 years. There are no heavy metals left worth shipping. No minerals worth a local salvage operation's time, much less Opus Dei's.
Major Piet slipped his visor up and rubbed the stubble on his chin.
Something was being shipped in quantity here, Your Excellencies. 8 dropships, a sophisticated grid system, automated security.
If the Shrike, or whatever it was, had not destroyed the computers and record systems, began Commander Browning.
Major Piet shook his head.
It wasn't the Shrike. The computers had already been destroyed by shaped charges and tailored DNA viruses.
He looked around the empty administrative building. Red sand had already found its way in through portals and seams.
It's my guess that these people destroyed their own records before the Shrike arrived. I think they were on the verge of clearing out. That's why the dropships were all in pre-launch mode, their onboard computers set to go.
Father Farrell nodded. But all we have are the orbital coordinates. No records of who or what they were going to rendezvous with there. Major Piet looked out the window at the dust storm blowing there.
There are 20 ground car buses in that lot, he murmured as if speaking to himself. Each one can transport up to 80 people. A bit of logistical overkill if the Opus Dei contingent here amounted to just the 360-some people whose bodies we found.
Governor Paulo frowned and crossed her arms.
We don't know how many Opus Dei personnel were here, Major. As you pointed out, the records were destroyed. Perhaps there were thousands.
Commander Browning stepped into the circle of VIPs.
Begging your pardon, Governor, but the barracks within the field perimeter here could house about 400 people. I think that the Major may be right. All of the Opus Dei personnel may be accounted for in the bodies we found.
You can't be sure of that, Commander, said Governor Paulo, her voice sounding displeased.
No, ma'am.
She gestured toward the dust storm that had all but obscured the parked buses.
And we have evidence that they needed transport for many more people.
Perhaps they were an advance contingent, said Commander Browning, preparing the way for a much larger population.
Then why destroy the records and limited AIs, said Major Piet. Why does it look like they were preparing to move out for good?
The Grand Inquisitor stepped into the circle and held up one black gloved hand.
We'll end the speculation for now. The Holy Office will begin taking depositions and carrying out interrogations tomorrow. Governor, may we use your office at the palace?
Of course, Your Excellency.
Paula lowered her face, either to show deference or to hide her eyes, or both.
Very good, said the Grand Inquisitor.
Commander, Major, call the skimmers. We'll leave the forensic teams and the morgue workers out here.
Cardinal Mustafa peered out at the worsening storm. Its howl could be heard through the 10 layers of window plastic now.
What's the local word for this dust storm?
Simoom, said Governor Paulo.
The storms used to cover the entire world. They're growing in intensity every Martian year.
The locals say that it's the old Martian gods, whispered Archbishop Robeson. They're reclaiming their own.
Less than 14 light-years out from Old Earth System, above the world called Vitis Grey Balianis B, a starship that had once been named Raphael but which now held no name, finished its braking run into geosynchronous orbit. The four living things on board floated in zero-G, their gazes fixed on the image of the desert world on the plot board. "How reliable is our reading on perturbations in the Farcaster field these days?" said the female named Scylla. "More reliable than most other clues," said her seeming twin Rhadamanth Nemes. "We'll check it out."
"Shall we start with one of the pack's bases?" said the male named Gyges.
"The largest," said Nemes.
"That would be Pax Base Bombacino," said Briareus, checking the code on the plot board. "Northern Hemisphere, along the Central Canal route, population of..."
"It doesn't matter what the population is," interrupted Rhadamanth Nemes.
"It just matters whether the child Anea and the android and that bastard Endymion have come that way."
"Dropships prepped," said Scylla.
They screeched into atmosphere, extended wings just as they crossed the Terminator, used the Vatican diskey code via transponder to clear the way for their landing, and set down amid scorpions, troopship skimmers, and armored EMVs. A flustered lieutenant greeted them and escorted them to the base commander's office.
"You say that you're members of the Noble Guard?" said Commander Solznikov,
studying their faces and the readout on the disky interface at the same time.
"We have said it," Rhadamanth Nemes replied tonelessly. "Our papers, order chips, and disky have said it. How many repetitions do you require, Commander?"
Solznikov's face and neck reddened above the high collar of his tunic. He looked down at the interface hollow instead of replying. Technically, these Noble Guard officers, members of one of the Pope's exotic new units, could pull rank on him. Technically, they could have him shot or excommunicated, since their ranks of cohort leaders in the Noble Guard combined the powers of both Pax Fleet and the Vatican. Technically, according to the wording and priority encryption of the diskey, they could pull rank on a planetary governor or dictate church policy to a world's presiding archbishop. Technically, Solznikov wished these pale freaks had never shown up on his backwater world. The commander forced a smile.
"Our forces here are at your disposal. What can I do for you?"
The thin, pale woman named Nemes held a holo card over the commander's desk and activated it. Suddenly, the life-size heads of three people floated in the space between them, or rather two people, since the third face was obviously that of a blue-skinned android.
"I didn't think that there were any androids left in the packs," said Solznikov.
"Have you had reports of any of these three in your territory, Commander?" said Nemes, ignoring his question. "It is probable that they would have been reported along the major river which runs from your north pole to the equator."
"It's actually a canal," began Solznikov and stopped.
None of the four looked as if they had any interest in small talk or extraneous information. He called his aide, Colonel Venara, into the office.
"Their names?" said Solznikov, as Venara stood poised with his comm log ready.
Nemes gave three names that meant nothing to the commander.
"Those aren't local names," he said as Colonel Venara checked records. "Members of the indigenous culture, it's called the Amoyeti Spectrum Helix, tend to accumulate names the way my hunting dog back on Patofa collected ticks. You see, they have this triune marriage arrangement where..."
"These are not locals," interrupted Nemes.
Her thin lips looked as bloodless as the rest of her pale face above the red uniform collar. "They're off-worlders."
"Ah, well," said Solznikov, relieved that he would not be dealing with these Noble Guard freaks for more than a minute or two more. "Then we can't help you. You see, Bombacino's the only working spaceport on Vitus Gray Balianus B, now that we closed down the indigene operation at Koroa Tambat. And except for a few spacers who end up in our brig, there's no immigration at all here. The locals are all Spectrum Helix, and, well, they like colors, they surely do, but an android would stand out like a... Well, Colonel?"
Colonel Venara looked up from his database search.
"Neither the images nor names match anything in our records, except for an all-points bulletin sent through via Pax Fleet about 4.5 standard years ago."
He looked questioningly at the Noble Guardsman.
Nemes and her siblings stared back without comment. Commander Solznikov spread his hands.
"I'm sorry. We've been busy for the last local 2 weeks on a major training exercise I had running here, but if anyone had come through here who matched these descriptions..."
"Sir," said Colonel Venara,
"there were those four runaway spacers."
"God damn it," thought Solznikov to the noble guardsman, he said. "Four mercantilist spacers who jumped ship rather than face charges for use of illegal drugs. As I remember it, they were all men, all in their 60s, and..."
He turned significantly to Colonel Venara, trying to tell him to shut the fuck up with his gaze and tone.
"And we found their bodies in the Big Greasy, didn't we, Colonel?"
"Three bodies, sir," said Colonel Venara, oblivious to his commander's signals. He was checking the database again.
"One of our skimmers went down near Koroa Tambat, and Med dispatched, Dr. Abney Molina to go down canal with a missionary to care for the injured crew."
"What the hell does this have to do with anything, Colonel?" snapped Solznikov. "These officers are searching for a teenager, a man in his 30s, and an android."
"Yes, sir," said Venara, looking up, startled, from his comm log. "But Dr. Molina radioed in that she had treated a sick off-worlder in Lockchild Lamond. We assumed that it was the fourth spacer."
Radamanth Nemes took a step forward so quickly that Commander Solznikov flinched involuntarily. There was something about the slim woman's movements that was not quite human.
"Where is Lockchild Lamond?" demanded Nemes.
"It's just a village along the canal, about 80 clicks south of here," said Solznikov. He turned to Colonel Venara as if all this commotion were his aide's fault.
"When are they flying the prisoner back?"
"Tomorrow morning, sir. We have a med skimmer scheduled to pick up the crew in Koroa Tambat at 0600 hours, and they'll stop in."
The colonel stopped speaking as the four Noble Guard officers spun on their heels and made for the door. Nemes paused just long enough to say,
"Commander, clear our flight path between here and this Lockchild Lamond. We'll be taking the dropship."
That's not necessary," said the commander, checking the screen on his desk. "The spacer is under arrest and will be delivered."
"Hey!"
The four Noble Guard officers had clattered down the steps outside his office and were crossing the tarmac. Solznikov rushed out onto the landing and shouted after them.
"Dropships aren't allowed to operate in atmosphere here except to land at Bombacino. Hey! We'll send a skimmer! Hey! This spacer's almost certainly not one of your... He's under guard! Hey!"
The four did not look back as they reached their ship, ordered an escalator to morph down to them, and disappeared through the dropship hull. Sirens went off across the base and personnel ran for shelter as the heavy dropship lifted on thrusters, shifted to EM, and accelerated south across the port perimeter.
"Jesus fucking Christ," whispered Commander Solznikov.
"Pardon me, sir," said Colonel Venara.
Solznikov gave him a glare that would have melted lead.
"Dispatch two combat skimmers immediately. No, make that three. I want a squad of Marines aboard each skimmer. This is our turf, and I don't want these anemic Noble Guard pissants doing so much as littering without our say-so. I want the skimmers there first, and that fucking spacer taken into custody. Our custody. If it means hair-lipping every Spectrum Helix indigene between here and Lockchild Lamond. Savvy, Colonel?"
Venara could only stare at his commander.
"Move!"
shouted Commander Solznikov. Colonel Venara moved.